Powers, Annals of the Western Shore, Book 3, by Ursula K. Le Guin, DB 65916. Copyright 2007 by Ursula K. Le Guin. Read by Eric Sandvold. Lindsay Ellison was unavailable to continue reading of this series. This book contains 502 pages. Approximate reading time, 13 hours. This book contains markers allowing direct access to the parts at Level 1 and the chapters at Level 2. Library of Congress Annotation. Gavir, a young house slave, takes his older sister Sallow's advice to keep secret his ability to occasionally see into the future. After Sallow is killed, Gavir escapes from slavery to explore the world and his psychic powers. Sequel to Voices, RC 63672, for grades 6 to 9, 2007. From the book jacket, young Gavir, brought up in comfort as a house slave for a great family, sometimes sees into the future, a power he cannot explain or control, and one that his beloved older sister wisely advises him to keep secret. But when tragedy destroys his trust in all he has ever known, he flees in blind grief, finding himself on a dangerous journey towards a goal he does not understand. Is he seeking freedom, or his own people, or the true use of his strange powers? This third book of the Annals of the Western Shore is an epic story of survival and self-discovery that brings its hero home at last to a place where he has never been before. About the author. Ursula K. Le Guin is the author of more than 40 works of fiction for adults and children. The second book of her Earthsea cycle, The Tombs of Atuan, was awarded a Newbery Honor. The third book, The Farthest Shore, won the National Book Award, and she holds the Margaret A. Edwards Award for her lifetime contribution to young adult literature. She lives in Portland, Oregon, and can be visited at www.ursulakleguin.com. Other books by Ursula K. Le Guin. The Telling, Changing Plains, Annals of the Western Shore, including Gifts, Voices, The Earthsea Cycle, including A Wizard of Earthsea, Tahanu, Tales from Earthsea, The Other Wind. Reader's Note: Map found in the print edition is not included in this recording. End of Reader's Note. Powers. Part 1. 1.
Don't talk about it, Sallow tells me. But what if it's going to happen? Like when I saw the snow? That's why not to talk about it.
My sister puts her arm around me and rocks us sideways, left and right, as we sit on the schoolroom bench. The warmth and the hug and the rocking ease my mind, and I rock back against Sallow, bumping her a little. But I can't keep from remembering what I saw, the dreadful excitement of it. And pretty soon I burst out, "But I ought to tell them. It was an invasion. They could warn the soldiers to be ready."
"And they'd say, when?"
That stumps me. "Well, just ready."
"But what if it doesn't happen for a long time? They'd be angry at you for giving a false alarm. And then if an army did invade the city, they'd want to know how you knew."
"I'd tell them I remembered it."
"No," Sallow says. "Don't ever tell them about remembering the way you do. They'll say you have a power, and they don't like people to have powers."
"But I don't. Just sometimes I remember things that are going to happen."
"I know. But Gavir, listen, truly. You mustn't talk about it to anybody. Not anybody but me."
When Sallow says my name in her soft voice, when she says,
"Listen, truly,"
I do truly listen to her, even though I argue. "Not even Tib?"
"Not even Tib. Her round brown face and dark eyes are quiet and serious. Why?
Because only you and I are marsh people.
So was Gammy.
It was Gammy that told me what I'm telling you. That marsh people have powers, and the city people are afraid of them. So we never talk about anything we can do that they can't. It would be dangerous, really dangerous. Promise, Gav.
She puts up her hand, palm out. I fit my grubby paw against it to make the vow. I promise, I say, as she says,
I hear.
In her other hand, she's holding the little enume she wears on a cord around her neck. She kisses the top of my head, and then bumps me so hard I nearly fall off the end of the bench. But I won't laugh. I'm so full of what I remembered. It was so awful and so frightening. I want to talk about it, to tell everybody, to say, look out, soldiers are coming, enemies, with a green flag, setting the city on fire. I sit swinging my legs, sullen and mournful.
Tell me about it again,
Sallow says.
Tell all the bits you left out.
That's what I need. And I tell her again my memory of the soldiers coming up the street. Sometimes what I remember has a secret feeling about it, as if it belongs to me, like a gift that I can keep and take out and look at when I'm by myself, like the eagle feather Yavindi gave me, the first thing I ever remembered. The place with the reeds and the water is like that. I've never told anybody about it, not even Sallow. There's nothing to tell, just the silvery blue water and reeds in the wind and sunlight and a blue hill way off. Lately, I have a new remembering. The man in the high room in shadows who turns around and says my name. I haven't told anybody that. I don't need to. But there's the other kind of remembering, or seeing, or whatever it is, like when I remembered seeing the father come home from Pagadi, and his horse was lame. Only he hadn't come home yet, and didn't until next summer. And then he came just as I remembered, on the lame horse. And once I remembered all the streets of the city turning white, and the roofs turning white, and the air full of tiny white birds all whirling and flying downward. I wanted to tell everybody about that, it was so amazing. And I did. Most of them didn't listen. I was only 4 or 5 then, but it snowed later that winter. Everybody ran outside to see the snowfall, a thing that happens in Itra maybe once in 100 years, so that we children didn't even know what it was called. Gammy asked me,
"Is this what you saw? Was it like this?"
And I told her and all of them it was just what I'd seen, and she and Tib and Sallow believed me. That must have been when Gammy told Sallow what Sallow had just told me, not to talk about things I remembered that way. Gammy was old and sick then, and she died in the spring after the snowfall. Since then, I'd only had the secret rememberings, until this morning. I was by myself, early in the morning, sweeping the hall outside the nursery rooms, when I began remembering. At first I just remembered looking down a city street and seeing fire leap up from a house roof and hearing shouts. The shouts got louder, and I recognized Long Street, running north from the square behind the forefather's shrine. At the far end of the street, smoke was billowing out in big, greasy clouds with red flames inside them. People were running past me, all over the square, women and men, most of them running towards the Senate Square, shouting and calling out. But city guards ran by in the other direction with their swords drawn. Then I could see soldiers at the far end of Long Street under a green banner. They had long lances, and the ones on horseback had swords. The guards met with them, and there was deep shouting, and ringing and clashing like a smithy. And the whole crowd of men, a great writhing knot of armor and helmets and bare arms and swords, came closer and closer. A horse broke from it, galloping up the street straight at me, riderless, lathered with white sweat streaked red, blood running from where its eye should be. The horse was screaming. I dodged back from it. And then I was in the hall with a broom in my hand, remembering it. I was still terrified. It was so clear I couldn't forget it at all. I kept seeing it again, and seeing more. I had to tell somebody. So when Sallow and I went to get the schoolroom ready, and were there alone, I told her. And now I told her all over again. And telling it made me remember it again, and I could see and tell it better. Sallow listened intently, and shivered when I described the horse.
What kind of helmets did they have?
I looked at the memory of the men fighting in the street. Black, mostly. One of them had a black crest, like a horse's tail.
Do you think they were from Osk?
They didn't have those long wood shields like the Oskan captives in the parade. It was like all their armor was metal, bronze or iron. It made this huge clanging sound when they were fighting with the guards with swords. I think they came from Morva.
Who came from Morva, Gav?
Said a pleasant voice behind us, and we both jumped like puppets on strings. It was Yavin. Intent on my story, neither of us had heard him, and we had no idea how long he'd been listening. We reverenced him quickly, and Sallow said,
Gav was telling me one of his stories, Yavin D.
Sounds like a good one, Yavin said. Troops from Morva would march with a black and white banner, though.
Who has green? I asked.
Kasikar.
He sat down on the front bench, stretching out his long legs. Yavin Altantar Arka was 17, the eldest son of the father of our house. He was an officer in training of the Itrin army, and away on duty much of the time now. But when he was home, he came to the schoolroom for lessons just as he used to. We loved having him there, because being grown up, he made us all feel grown up, and because he was always good-natured, and because he knew how to get Avera, our teacher, to let us read stories and poems instead of doing grammar and logic exercises. The girls were coming in now, and Torm ran in with Tib and Hobie from the ball court, sweating. And finally, Avera entered, tall and grave in his gray robe. We all reverenced the teacher and sat down on the benches. There were 11 of us, 4 children of the family and 7 children of the house. Yavin and Torm were the sons of the Arka family. Astano was the daughter, and Sotur was their cousin. Among the house slaves, Tib and Hobie were boys of 12 and 13, I was 11, and Riss and my sister Sallow were 13. Oko and her little brother Miv were much younger, just learning their letters. All the girls would be educated till they were grown and given. Tib and Hobie, having learned to read and write and recite bits of the epics, would be let out of school for good come spring. They couldn't wait to get out and learn to work. I was being educated to be a teacher, so my work would always be here, in the long schoolroom with its high windows. When Yavin and Torm had children, I would teach those children, and the children of their slaves. Yavin invoked the spirits of his ancestors to bless our work today, and Avera reproved Sallow and me for not setting out the school books, and we got to work. Almost immediately, Avera had to call up Tib and Hobie for scuffling. They stuck out their hands palm up, and he whacked each one once with his yardstick. There was little beating in our command, and no tortures such as we heard of in other houses. Sallow and I had never even been struck. The shame of being reproved was quite enough to make us behave. Hobie and Tib had no shame, and, as far as I could see, no fear of punishment either, and hands as hard as leather. They grimaced and grinned, and all but sniggered when Avera struck them. And indeed, his heart wasn't in it. Like them, he couldn't wait for them to be out of his schoolroom. He asked Astano to hear them recite their daily bit of history from the Acts of the City of Itra, while Oko helped her little brother write his alphabet. And the rest of us got on with reading the Moralities of Trudic. Old-fashioned, the old ways. Those were words we heard often in our command, spoken with absolute approval. I don't think any of us had the faintest idea why we had to memorize tiresome old Trudic, or even thought to ask. It was the tradition of the House of Arca to educate its people. Education meant learning to read the moralists and the epics and the poets of era called the classics, and studying the history of Ytra and the city-states, some geometry and principles of engineering, some mathematics, music, and drawing. That was the way it had always been. That was the way it was. Hobie and Tib had never got beyond Nemec's fables, and Torm and Riss depended a good deal on the rest of us to get them through Trudic. But Avera was an excellent teacher, and had swept Yavin and Sotur and Sallow and me right into the histories and the epics, which we all enjoyed, though none so keenly as Yavin and I. When we'd finally finished discussing the importance of self-restraint, as exemplified in the 41st Morality, I snapped Trudic shut and reached for the copy of The Siege of Oshir that I shared with Sallow. We had just started reading it last month. I knew every line I'd read by heart. Our teacher saw me. His long, gray-black eyebrows went up.
"Gavir," he said, "will you now please hear Tib and Hobie recite, so that Astano Io can join us in reading?"
I knew why Avera did it. It wasn't meanness, it was morality. He was training me to do what I didn't want to do, and not do what I did want to do, because that was a lesson I had to learn. The 41st. I gave Sallow the book and went over to the side bench. Astano gave me the book of the Acts of the City and a sweet smile. She was 15, tall and thin, so light-skinned that her brothers called her the Ald, after the people in the eastern deserts who are said to have white skins and hair like sheep. But Ald also means stupid. Astano wasn't stupid, but she was shy, and had perhaps learned the 41st morality almost too well. Silent and proper and modest and self-contained, a perfect senator's daughter. You had to know Astano very well to know how warm-hearted she was and what unexpected thoughts she could think. It's hard for a boy of 11 to play the teacher to older boys who are used to bossing him around and roughing him up and who normally call him shrimp, swamp rat, or beaky. And Hobie hated taking orders from me. Hobie had been born on the same day as Torm, the son of the family. Everybody knew, but nobody said, he was Torm and Yavin's half-brother. His mother had been a slave. He was a slave. He received no special treatment. But he resented any slave who did. He'd always been jealous of my status in the classroom. He stared at me, frowning, as I stood before him and Tib, sitting side by side on the bench. Astano had closed the book, so I asked, "Where were you?"
"Sitting here all along, Beaky," Hobie said,
and Tib sniggered. What was hard to take was that Tib was my friend, but whenever he was with Hobie, he was Hobie's friend, not mine. "Go on reciting from where you left off," I said, speaking to Hobie, trying to sound cool and stern.
"I don't remember where it was."
"Then start over from where you started today."
"I don't remember where it was."
I felt the blood rise in my face and sing in my ears. Unwisely, I asked, "What do you remember?"
"I don't remember what I remember."
"Then begin at the beginning of the book."
"I don't remember it,"
Hobie said, carried away with the success of his ploy. That gave me the advantage.
"You don't remember any of the book at all?"
I said, raising my voice a little, and Avera immediately glanced our way.
"All right," I said. "Tib, say the first page for Hobie."
Under our teacher's eye, he didn't dare not to, and set off gabbling the origin of the Acts, which they'd both known by heart for months. I stopped him at the end of the page and told Hobie to repeat it. That made Hobie really angry. I'd won. I knew I'd pay for it later. But he muttered the sentences through. I said,
Now go on where you left off with Estano Io. And he obeyed, droning out the act of conscription. Tib, I said, paraphrase. That's what Avera always had us do, to show we understood what we'd memorized.
Tib,
Hobie said in a little squeaky murmur.
Paraphrase.
Tib broke into giggles. Go on, I ordered.
Go on, paraphrase.
Hobie whispers squeaked, and Tib giggled helplessly. Avera was talking about a passage in the epic, lecturing away, his eyes shining, the others all listening intently. But Yavin, sitting on the second bench, glanced over at us. He gazed at Hobie with a sharp frown. Hobie shrank into himself and looked at the floor. He kicked Tib's ankle. Tib immediately stopped giggling. After some struggle and hesitation, he said,
It means that if the city is threatened with an attack, the Senate will, what is it?
Convene, I said.
Convene and debilitate.
Deliberate.
Deliberate the conscription of able-bodied freemen. Is deliberate like liberate, only the opposite?
That was one reason I loved Tib. He heard words. He asked questions. He had a strange, quick mind. But nobody else valued it, so he didn't either. No, it means talk something over.
If you paraphrase it,
Hobie muttered. We mumbled and stumbled through the rest of their recitation. I was putting away the acts with great relief when Hobie leaned forward from his bench, staring at me, and said between his teeth,
Master's pet.
I was used to being called teacher's pet. It was inevitable. It was true. But our teacher wasn't a master. He was a slave like us. This was different. Master's pet meant toady, sneak, traitor. And Hobie said it with real hatred. He was jealous of Yavin's intervention on my behalf, and shamed by it. We all admired Yavin, and longed for his approval. Hobie seemed so rough and indifferent, it was hard for me to understand that he might love Yavin as much as I did, with less ability to please him, and more reason to feel humiliated when Yavin sided with me against him. All I knew was that the name he'd called me was hateful and unfair, and I burst out aloud, I'm not!
Not what, Gavir?
Said Avera's cold voice. Not what Hobie said. It doesn't matter. I'm sorry, teacher. I apologize for interrupting. I apologize to all.
A cold nod. Sit down and be silent, then,
Avera said. I went back to sit by my sister. For a while, I couldn't read the lines of the book Sallow held in front of both of us. My ears kept ringing, and my eyes were blurred. It was horrible what Hobie had called me. I'd never be a master's pet. I wasn't a sneak. I'd never be like Riff, a housemaid who'd spied on the other maids and tattled, thinking to gain favor. But the mother of Arca told her, I don't like sneaks, and had her sold at the market. Riff was the only adult slave who had been sold from our house in all my life. There was trust on both sides. There had to be. When the morning lesson was over, Avera gave punishment for disturbing the class. Tib and Hobie were to learn an extra page of the Acts. All three of us were to write out the 41st lesson of Trudic's Moralities, and I was to copy out 30 lines of Garrow's epic poem, The Siege and Fall of Sentos, into the fair copy book and have them memorized by tomorrow. I don't know whether Avera realized that most of his punishments were rewards to me. Probably he knew it, but at the time I saw our teacher as old and wise beyond mere human feeling. It didn't occur to me that he thought about me at all or could care what I felt. And because he called copying poetry punishment, I tried to believe that it was. In fact, I was clamping my tongue between my teeth most of the time I was writing out the lines. My writing was scrabbly and irregular. The fair copy book would be used in future classes, just as we used the books that previous generations of students had copied out when they were children in this schoolroom. Astano had copied the last passage in this book. Under her small, elegant writing, almost as clear as the printed books from Mason, my lines went scrawling and straggling pitifully along. Looking at how messy they were was my real punishment. As for memorizing them, I'd already done that. My memory is unusually exact and complete. When I was a child and adolescent, I could call up a page of a book, or a room I'd seen, or a face, if I'd looked at it with any attention at all, and look at it again as if it were in front of me. So it was, perhaps, that I confused my memories with what I called remembering, which was not memory, but something else. Tib and Hobie ran outdoors, putting off their tasks till later. I stayed in the schoolroom and finished mine. Then I went to help Sallow with sweeping the halls and courtyards, which was our perpetual task. After we'd swept the silkroom courts, we went for a piece of bread and cheese at the pantry handout, and I would have gone back to sweeping, but Torm had sent Tib to tell me to come and be soldiers. Sweeping the courts and corridors of that enormous house was no small job. It was expected that they be clean always, and it took Sallow and me a good part of the day to keep them that way. I didn't like to leave Sallow with all the rest of it, when she'd already done a lot while I did my punishment, but I couldn't disobey Torm.
"Oh, you go on,"
she said, lazily pushing her broom along in the shade of the arches of the central atrium.
"It's all done but this."
So I ran out happily to the Sycamore Park, under the city walls, a few streets south of Archimand, where Torm was already drilling Tib and Hobie. I loved being soldiers. Yavin was tall and lithe, like his sister Astano and the mother, but Torm took after the father, compact and muscular. There was something a little amiss with Torm, something askew. He didn't limp, but he walked with a kind of awkward plunge. The two sides of his face didn't quite seem to fit together, so he looked lopsided, and he had unpredictable rages, sometimes real fits, screaming, hitting out wildly, or tearing at his own clothes and body. Coming into adolescence now, he seemed to be growing together. His furies had calmed down, and he was making an excellent athlete of himself. All his thoughts were about the army, being a soldier, going to fight with Itra's legions. The army wouldn't take him even as a cadet for 2 years yet, so he made Hobie and Tib and me into his army. He'd been drilling us for months. We kept our wooden swords and shields in a secret cache under one of the big old sycamores in the park, along with the greaves and helmets of leather scraps Sallow and I had made under Torm's direction. His helmet had a plume of reddish horsehairs, which Sallow had picked up in the stables and sewn in, so it looked quite grand. We always drilled in a long grass alley, deep in the grove, right under the wall, a secluded place. I saw the three of them marching down the alley as I came running through the trees. I snatched up my cap and shield and sword and fell in with them, panting. We drilled for a while, practicing turning and halting at Torm's orders. Then we had to stand at attention while our eagle-eyed commander strode up and down his regiment, berating a man here for having his helmet on crooked and a man there for not standing up straight or changing his expression or letting his eyes move.
"A shoddy lot of troops," he growled. "Damned civilians! How can Itra ever defeat the Votizens with a rabble like this?"
We stood expressionless, staring straight ahead, resolving in our hearts to defeat the Votizens come what might.
"All right,"
Torm said at last.
"Tib, you and Gav are the Votizens. Me and Hobie are Itra. You go man the earthworks, and we'll do a cavalry attack."
"They always get to be the Itrans," Tib said to me as we ran off to man the earthworks, an old, half-overgrown drainage ditch that led out from the wall nearby.
Why can't we be the Eatrins sometimes? It was a ritual question. There was no answer. We scuttled into the ditch and prepared to meet the onslaught of the cavalry of Eatra. For some reason, they took quite a while coming, and Tib and I had time to build up a good supply of missiles, small clods of hard, dry dirt from the side of the ditch. When we finally heard the neighing and snorting of the horses, we stood up and hurled our missiles furiously. Most of them fell short or missed, but one clod happened to hit Hobie smack on the forehead. I don't know whether Tib or I threw it. It stopped him short for a moment, stunned him. His head bobbed strangely back and forth, and he stood staring. Torm was charging on, shouting,
"At them, men! For the ancestors! Eatra! Eatra!"
and came leaping down into the ditch. He remembered to whinny as he leaped. Tib and I fell back before the furious onslaught, naturally, which gave Torm time to look around for Hobie. Hobie was coming at a dead run. His face was black with dirt and rage. He jumped into the ditch and ran straight at me with his wooden sword lifted up to slash down at me. Backed up against bushes in the ditch, I had nowhere to go. All I could do was raise my shield and strike out with my sword as best I could, parrying his blow. The wooden blades slid against each other, and mine, turned aside by his much stronger blow, flicked up against his face. His came down hard on my hand and wrist. I dropped my sword and howled with pain.
"Hey!"
Torm shouted.
"No hitting!"
For he had given us very strict rules of how to use our weapons. We were to dance fight with our swords. We could thrust and parry, but were never to strike home with them. Torm came between us now, and I had his attention first because I was crying and holding out my hand, which hurt fiercely. Then he turned to Hobie. Hobie stood holding his hands over his face, blood welling between his fingers.
"What's wrong? Let me look,"
Torm said, and Hobie said,
"I can't see. I'm blind."
There wasn't any water nearer than the Arca fountain. Our commander kept his head. He ordered Tib and me to hide the weapons in the usual place and follow at once, while he led Hobie home. We caught up to them at the fountain in the square in front of our command. Torm was washing the dirt and blood off Hobie's face.
"It didn't hit your eye," he said. "I'm sure it didn't." "Not quite."
It was not possible to be sure. The rough point of my wooden sword, driven upward by Hobie's, had made a ragged cut above or on the eye, and blood was still pouring out of it. Torm wadded up a strip torn from his tunic and had Hobie press it against the wound.
"It's all right," he said to Hobie. "It'll be all right. An honorable wound, soldier."
And Hobie, discovering that he could see from his left eye at least, now the blood and dirt was no longer blinding him, stopped crying. I stood at attention nearby, frozen with dread. When I saw that Hobie could see, it was a huge relief. I said, "I'm sorry, Hobie." He looked round at me, glaring with the eye that wasn't hidden by the wad of cloth.
"You little sneak," he said. "You threw that rock, then you went for my face."
"It wasn't a rock. It was just dirt. And I didn't try to hit you. With the sword, I mean, it just flew up. When you hit—"
"Did you throw a rock?"
Torm demanded of me. And both Tib and I were denying it, saying we had just thrown clods, when suddenly Torm's face changed, and he too stood at attention. His father, our father, the father of our command, Altan Serpesco Arca, walking home from the Senate, had seen us by the fountain. He now stood a yard or two away, looking at the four of us. His bodyguard, Metter, stood behind him. The father was a broad-shouldered man, with strong arms and hands. His features, round forehead and cheeks, snub nose, narrow eyes, were full of energy and assertive power. We reverenced him and stood still.
What is this?
He said.
Is the boy hurt?
We were playing, father, Torm said. He got a cut.
Is the eye hurt?
No, sir. I don't think so, sir.
Send him to Remen at once. What is that?
Tib and I had tossed our headgear into the weapon cache, but Torm's crested helmet was still on his head, and so was Hobie's less ornate one. Cap, sir.
It's a helmet. Have you been playing at soldiers with these boys?
He looked us three over once more, a flick of the eye. Torm stood mute.
You,
the father said to me, no doubt assessing me as the youngest, feeblest, and most overawed.
Were you playing at soldiers?
I looked in terror to Torm for guidance, but he stood mute and stiff-faced.
Drilling, Altandi,
I whispered.
Fighting, it looks like. Show me that hand.
He did not speak threateningly or angrily, but with perfect, cold authority. I held out my hand, puffed up red and purple around the base of the thumb and the wrist by now.
What weapons?
Again I looked to Torm in an agony of appeal. Should I lie to the father? Torm stared straight ahead. I had to answer. Wooden, Altandi.
Wooden swords? What else?
Shields, Altandi.
He's lying, Torm said suddenly. He doesn't even drill with us. He's just a kid. We were trying to climb some trees in the sycamore grove and Hobie fell and a branch gashed him.
Altan Arka stood silent for a while, and I felt the strangest mixture of wild hope and utter dread thrill through me, running on the track of Torm's lie. The father spoke slowly.
But you were drilling?
Sometimes, Torm said, and paused. Sometimes I drill them.
With weapons?
He stood mute again. The silence stretched on to the limit of endurance.
You,
the father said to Tib and me,
bring the weapons to the back courtyard. Torm, take this boy to Remen and get him looked after. Then come to the back courtyard.
We all ducked in reverence and got away as fast as we could. Tib was crying and chattering with fear, but I was in a queer, sick state, like a fever, and nothing seemed very real. I felt calm enough, but could not speak. We went to the cache and hauled out the wooden swords and shields, the helmets and greaves, and carried them round the back way to the rear courtyard of our command. We made a little pile of them there and stood by them waiting. The father came out, having changed into house clothes. He strode over to us, and I could feel Tib shrinking into himself with terror. I reverenced and stood still. I was not afraid of the father, not as I was afraid of Hobie. I was in awe of him. I trusted him. He was completely powerful, and he was just. He would do what was right, and if we had to suffer, we had to suffer. Torm came out, striding along like a short edition of his father. He halted by the sad little heap of wooden weapons and saluted him. He kept his chin up.
You know that to give a slave any weapon is a crime, Torm.
Torm mumbled, yes, sir.
You know there are no slaves in the army of Itra. Soldiers are free men. To treat a slave as a soldier is an offense. A disrespect to the army, to the ancestors. You know that.
Yes, sir.
You are guilty of that crime, that offense, that disrespect.
Torm stood still, though his face was quivering terribly.
So, shall the slaves be punished for it? Or you?
Torm's eyes opened wide at that, a possibility that clearly had not occurred to him. He still said nothing. There was a long pause.
"Who commanded?"
the father said at last.
"Me, sir."
"So?"
Another long pause.
"So I should be punished."
Altan Arka nodded very briefly.
"And they?"
he asked. Torm struggled and finally muttered,
"They were doing what I told them to, sir."
"Are they to be punished for following your orders?"
"No, sir."
The brief nod again. He looked at Tib and me as if from a great distance.
"Burn that trash,"
he told us.
"Consider this, you boys. Obeying a criminal order is a crime. Only because your master takes the responsibility do you go free. You're the marsh boy, Gav, is it? And you?"
"Tib, sir. Kitchen, sir,"
Tib whispered.
"Burn that stuff and get back to work. Come,"
he said to Torm, and the two of them marched off side by side under the long arcade. They looked like soldiers on parade. We went to the kitchen for fire, brought back a burning stick from the hearth there, and laboriously got the wooden swords and shields to burn. But then we put the leather caps and greaves on the fire, and they smothered it. We scraped up the half-burnt pieces of wood and stinking leather, getting a lot of small burns on our hands, and buried the mess in the kitchen midden. By then we were both sniveling. Being soldiers had been hard, frightening, glorious. We had been proud to be soldiers. I had loved my wooden sword. I used to go out alone to the cache to take it out and sing to it, smooth its rough, splintery blade with a stone, polish it with grease saved for my dinner. But it was all lies. We had never been soldiers, only slaves. Slaves and cowards. I had betrayed our commander. I was sick with defeat and shame. We were late for afternoon lessons. We ran through the house to the schoolroom and rushed in panting. The teacher looked at us with disgust.
"Go wash,"
was all he said. We hadn't looked at our filthy hands and clothes. Now I saw Tib's face all smeared with soot and snot, and knew mine was like it.
"Go with them and get them clean, Sallow,"
Vera added. I think he sent her with us out of kindness, seeing we were both badly upset. I had seen Torm in his usual place on the schoolroom bench, but Hobie had not been there.
"What happened?"
Sallow asked us as we went to wash, and at the same time I asked, "What did Torm say?"
"He said the father ordered you to burn some toys, so you might be late to class."
Torm had covered for us, made us an excuse. It was a great relief, and so undeserved after my betrayal of him that I could have cried in gratitude.
"But what toys? What were you doing?"
I shook my head. Tib said, "Being soldiers for Tormdi."
"Shut up, Tib,"
I said too late.
"Why should I? It makes trouble. It wasn't our fault. The father said so. He said it was Tormdi's fault."
"It wasn't. Just don't talk about it. You're betraying him."
"Well, he lied," Tib said. "He said we were climbing trees."
"He was trying to keep us out of trouble."
"Or himself," Tib said.
We had got to the courtyard fountain by now, and Sallow more or less pushed our heads underwater and rubbed and scrubbed us clean. It took a while. The water stung, and then felt cool on my various burns and my puffy, aching hand. Between scrubs and rinses, Sallow got the story out of us. She didn't say much, except to Tib, Gavi's right. Don't talk about it.
Going back to the schoolroom, I asked, Is Hobie going to be blind in that eye?
Tormdi just said he was hurt,
Sallow said. Hobie's really angry at me, I said.
So?
Sallow said, fierce.
You didn't mean to hurt him, and he did mean to hurt you. If he tries it again, he'll get into some real trouble.
She spoke the truth. Gentle and easygoing as she was, she'd fire up and fight for me like a mother cat for her kittens. Everybody knew that. And she'd never liked Hobie. She put her arm around me for a moment before we got back to the schoolroom, leaning on me and bumping me. And I leaned on her and bumped her, and everything was all right again. Almost.